Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Robert Draper is our guest this hour, contributing writer for the National Geographic magazine, and he's done an extremely interesting piece in the current issue, Rift in Paradise, as the global population soars toward 9 billion by 2045. This corner of Africa shows what's at stake in the decades ahead. The rift is rich in rainfall, deep lakes, volcanic soil, and biodiversity. It is also one of the most densely populated places on Earth, and a desperate competition for land and resources and between people and wildlife has erupted here with unspeakable violence. How can the conflict be stopped? Will there be any room left for the wild? We'll also talk about a few other things with Robert. He's a really interesting guy. He's a freelance writer and contributor to the New York Times Magazine. He worked for the Texas Monthly, and he is the author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush, a chronicle of the Bush administration from 2001 to 2007, which was published a couple of years ago. He's also written for Rolling Stone magazine and has written a novel. He is the grandson, those of you of a certain age will remember his grandfather quite well. I read this on Wikipedia, so I'm not sure if it's entirely true, but I do want to ask him. Leon Jaworski, prosecutor during the Watergate scandal, segregation trials, and Nazi war crimes as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls. He's also written a very interesting piece on opium wars in Afghanistan, so he's been all over the world covering extremely interesting stories. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Robert.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Thank you for being with us. Tell me about your grandfather first. Is this true?
It is true. That's my mother's father, Leon Jaworski. He was the Watergate special prosecutor, as you mentioned, from 1973 until 1974. He replaced Archibald Cox, who was fired in the so-called Friday Night Massacre. The colonel, as I knew him, was, among other things, a wonderful granddad. And, taught me how to throw a curveball and how to gut a catfish, but was also a real, a real role model for me. It's a wonderful thing for a kid to have within his proximity, someone who's achieved so much as Leon Jaworski had, while still being, a discernible human being. It was a reminder that, that accomplishments can be attained, and you don't have to lose your soul in the meantime.
Right. I'm glad that I found that out about you.
Sure.
We may get back to that. You have done some extraordinary reporting. This trip that you took in Africa and the people that you've interviewed, it seems like another world, but it is our world, and you really get at the root of what some of the current horrendous violence, the reasons for it. Tell me where you went.
Sure. I went and spent considerable time in the area of Central East Africa that's variously known as the Great Lakes region and the Albertine Rift. Now, just to put a finer point on that, this area encompasses a 920-mile-long crease or rift that's formed by shifting plate tectonics, many, many thousands of years ago. It's in the dead center of the continent of Africa, where the countries of Uganda, Rwanda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and to the south, Tanzania and Burundi meet. And it's this very, very geologically diverse area, really spectacularly diverse. It has highland forests and these snow-capped mountains, but also this chain of lakes from Lake Albert to the north to Lake Tanganyika to the south. And it's for that reason that the area has frequently been known as the Great Lakes region. I was there for two trips, one a little over a month and another about 2.5 weeks. And in those periods of time, spent a great deal of time, particularly in the eastern Congo and then in Uganda and Rwanda.
Mm-hmm. All of this has been the scene of, as you write, of a violence of mind-reeling proportions in this part of Africa and a huge humanitarian crisis, partially due to the number of people?
Yes, very much so. And the paradox to this area, Kathleen, has been that it's as I was sort of alluding to, a beautiful area. It's a very, very lush area, an area of plenty. It when the European explorers who were looking for the source of the Nile came to the Great Lakes region in the 19th century, they were sort of stunned not just by the lush vegetation, but by all of these organized societies that were around the lakes. It was for them a revelation. These explorers who, frankly, you know, took a not so enlightened view of societies other than their own back then, that here in the heart of darkness, as it were signs of civilization. But the paradox has been that this area of plenty naturally has become a magnet for people who have been looking for a better way of life, looking for arable farmland, looking for minerals. And unsurprisingly then, since those resources are finite, there has been an increasing struggle for all of what I just listed. And that struggle, that competition, which has, of course, been exacerbated by people, particularly impoverished people, having alarmingly high birth rates, has led to land disputes in particular, many of which have been settled at the point of a gun, the result of which have frequently been ethnic tensions between one group that has a claim to the land and another group. Militias have formed, politicians using to exploit the matter for their own gain have pitted one ethnic group against another, and in some areas, most notoriously in Rwanda in 1993, that has led to genocide.
Yeah. The horrific violence, you write, that has occurred in this place and continues in lawless Eastern Congo, despite a peace accord, is impossible to understand in simple terms. So let's go into the deeper, complicated terms. How do we understand this kind of horrific violence that you outline in the piece? And it's almost hard to hear it because it's just atrocious.
It's hard to hear it, and it's hard to see it, and you can see as well the seeds being planted for more of the same, particularly in the Eastern Congo. We can talk later about Rwanda, which has become kind of an unlikely success story for the region. But you know, what you see is a number of factors. One is there have been indigenous tribes that had an original claim to the land. Then came the colonizers in the latter part of the 19th century, and they took over the land while allowing some of the indigenous tribes to parcel out what remained. But when those colonizers came in, for example, when the Belgians were in Rwanda and then in the Eastern Congo, they wanted to establish these tea plantations, and they needed some laborers to work in them. They decided that the best, the most suited for that kind of work were the Hutu tribesmen. They had decided, the Belgians had, that the Tutsis, who were generally speaking taller, of thinner skin, and of these sort of more pronounced elongated noses, were ethnically superior, were of higher intelligence, and so the Tutsis were given better educations and better jobs, which then became kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of their level of advancement, while the Hutu were relegated to being fighters and laborers. They were then, many of the Hutu, brought by Belgians over into the Congo. Well, there were already the Bahunde and other tribes, the Banande, the Bahunde, that were there with lands of their own. You've got colonizers now claiming land. Now you have Hutu who need land. And each of them have, in their view, a valid claim to the land. Then come all these shifting populations due to these genocides and other conflicts. Whole groups of people move from one area, and indeed one country, to another. And they're looking for land as well. And so there is a lot of friction, born out not only by the scarcity of the land, not only by people attempting to flee conflict, but also by ethnic groups who have developed resentments against other ethnic groups because winners and losers, as it were picked out by colonizers, which laid a predicate for the resentments that festered into genocide.
Hmm. And they're gathering in this area that used to have a whole lot of wonderful resources, and because of the fights over those and the rivalries, those resources are diminishing?
Yes. In fact, because National Geographic is properly preoccupied with geography and with wildlife in addition to the human condition, I spent a lot of time researching this while I was there, and went, for example, to Virunga National Park, which is in the eastern Congo, flanking the Rwanda border. Virunga is the oldest national park, the most venerable national park in all of Africa. But it's not really a national park anymore, other than this tiny sliver of the park that is where tourists go to visit the mountain gorillas. About 90% of the park has been closed off to the public since the genocide, and is now a war zone. The photographer Pascal Maitre and I, when we visited it, stayed in the park headquarters, which was riddled with bullet holes. And there had been Congolese soldiers who had been living in the forest and naturally eating all of the wildlife. The reason they were living there was that the government had stopped paying them because the government had just claimed that it had run out of money. And so they were sort of, you know, living off the forest as pygmies and other groups have done in that area. Ultimately, they were pushed out by the rangers. But now these indigenous tribes, who are the warriors for the local population, which needs more land and wants, therefore, for much if not all of Virunga National Park to be returned to them, are occupying the park as well, are shooting at rangers. And in addition to all this bloodshed, unsurprisingly, the animal populations have been decimated. We visited an area, the Ashasha River, which constitutes the border of Uganda and the eastern Congo in one particular area. And this was a haven for hippos, but about 90% of them were killed. Oh. And they were killed by soldiers, either to eat the meat for themselves or to sell the meat in the black market, so that they'd have money. So yeah, it's unlike anything I've ever seen in a park. It's truly a wasteland there.
Oh, and what about the massive rapes that have occurred? Hundreds of thousands of women.
This is the most difficult to fathom, and it really does in a lot of ways, Kathleen. I mean, ultimately defy explanation. But I visited. You're correct that I think from 1996 until 2008. The Congo has seen an estimated 200,000 rapes of its women. But in the eastern Congo, just in the last year, there's been something like 8,000 women. I visited this village called Shasha, which is below Goma, which is the sort of sprawling unofficial capital of the eastern Congo. Shasha occupies this unfortunate crossroads where militias move east, west, and north, south. And as these militias move through and periodically engage in war with each other, they both to intimidate the local population, to suppress dissent, and to destroy a new generation of competing ethnic groups, they systematically rape all these women in the village. Again, ostensibly raping only, sexually violating only opposing tribes, but they really do not discriminate. And so I spent a day in the village of Shasha, and I remember I'd asked a woman who was a women's advocate in the area to introduce me to some of the rape victims, and there were hundreds of them. I interviewed one after another, and it became dozens and dozens, and they all sort of stood in this somber line outside this door. Many of them had children who were, who they had as a result of the rape. Virtually all of them, their husbands had left them because they considered it a source of shame, and they had thrown the women out of the houses. And all of these women, or most of them, had, were damaged physically as a result, and needed medication. But there's no medication, no AIDS organizations available in that particular area. So it really is, a kind of systematic violence and intimidation of a region, but that it has manifested itself in this particular violence towards innocent populations of women is a brutal and unfathomable construct.
Mm-hmm. When you met with, and you cite several conversations that you had with some fairly is an understatement, interesting people in the area. Who did you find who gave you some kind of hope, who had some answers to how to better this absolutely horrendous situation on all fronts?
I think that there was a guy I met randomly in Rwanda. My car had broken down, and so it was just me and my driver and my interpreter on the side of the road in Rwanda. If we had been a few miles to the west in the eastern Congo, we would have really been in trouble. Mm. But Rwanda has become a very safe country, and we were picked up by some guy who offered to drive us back into the city. And as I talked to this guy who was driving us, he was a young man who decided to open up a furniture shop. He had decided on his own to limit the number of children that he had. He decided to finish school. He decided that he would pay for his children's education. And he had a very sort of optimistic outlook on his country. And after visiting with him, I met with a number of government officials in Rwanda. And they have a sense of what certain seemingly intractable problems are in the area. And they have to do with a lack of education, among other things, people who can't get any kind of economic traction. The women just tend to fall into the lifestyle of having as many babies as possible, and so there's a strong contraception program in Rwanda, an education program. They're targeting in particular young women, girls, in an effort to raise their awareness and their standard of living. And this is all, you know, a remarkable staging ground for this sort of thing, given that Rwanda had been, in many ways, you know, the breeding ground for so many of the catastrophes that befall that area. Now, having said that, Rwanda not only is not out of the woods in terms of population problems, they have a terrible one, too, but Rwanda should not be viewed as, you know, a perfect model, because the Paul Kagame administration is one that brooks no dissent, where members of the press who ask the wrong questions are thrown in jail, where, you know, by and large, it's not a good idea to be standing up to the administration. Mm-hmm. Having said that, they have put in place a number of reforms that are the envy of that area.
We are going to welcome phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation. Robert Draper is our guest, and he has a piece in the current issue of National Geographic on Rift in Paradise. It's a deep article. It looks at a number of issues, global population, and the impact of global population on what used to be paradise in Africa, the Albertine Rift, what has happened to the wildlife, what has happened to the people, the incredibly horrendous violence that has taken place, which he calls of mind-reeling proportions. And he outlines some of this, including rape and slaughter of people and of animals as well. And it's in the current issue of National Geographic. He's really a man about the world, so he's done some other, and I do want to ask him about this before the end of this hour. He did a really interesting piece in February, I think it was, on opium wars, on weaning Afghan farmers off growing poppies, which I want to ask him how that's going. And he does a lot of writing. He writes for National Geographic. He's contributed to the New York Times Magazine. He worked for Texas Monthly. He's author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush, a chronicle of the Bush administration from 2001 to 2007. And he is our guest this hour. So here is how you join us. Maybe you just want to listen, but please feel free to join us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Robert Draper is our guest, contributing writer for the National Geographic Magazine. Our phone number, again, is 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. And we start our calls with Mike in Sister Bay. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning. My question is this: the core problem of the planet is overpopulation. And are there any politicians in Africa? And I wish we had more politicians here in the United States stepping forward. And even though it would be political suicide, to step forward and tell people to stop having children, very very bluntly, and because approaching 7 billion people now, and we're talking about 9 billion in 2040, the planet already cannot sustain all the people that we have. And thank you, and I'll listen.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the call.
That's a terrific question, and the answer, unsurprisingly, is no, there are not African leaders, you know, saying people stop having children. However, Kagame has implicitly said that. Now, and he, in doing so, is in stark contrast to, say, the Uganda president, Museveni, who has openly sort of lauded the burgeoning population of Uganda, has equated that burgeoning population with the increasing might of the country overall, when Ugandan leaders know full well that they have a terrible population problem there. In fact, it's interesting, when I was in Uganda, I went to Kagame Forest Reserve, which, as the name suggests, is supposed to be publicly held land that you know, no one's supposed to be living on. And yet I'd found these little villages within the forest where tons of young people had moved to and had ripped up the forest and begun to irrigate the land, begun to sort of carve out their own parcels of farmland and start families. And I asked them, well, you know, what are you guys doing here? And they said, actually, there were some politicians who said that we should move here. And as it turns out, in that part of the world, just as in America, the best way to get reelected is to promise people that you'll lower their taxes. The best way to get reelected in the Congo and in Uganda is to promise people that they'll have more access to land. And so, yeah, there's a lot of political cowardice there, hardly something limited to the continent of Africa, I should add. But in Rwanda, at least, as I was alluding to before, the Kagame administration has instituted programs that have as their specific intent lowering the population, lowering fertility rates, which are alarmingly high, and you know, for that they should be commended.
Mm. You write about, and maybe you want to spend more time talking about this because I'm interested in how Charles and the other pioneering young villagers who moved to Kagame in 2006, how they're eating, how they're getting by. This idea about land is just so important, isn't it? You quote him as saying, we'd been living on our grandparents' property, but there were too many people on the land already. We heard people talk about how there was free land this way. A migrant group had already begun to settle in Kagame when the National Forest Authority tried to evict them. Uganda's president, himself facing re-election, issued the executive order forbidding evictions.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. And I actually went out there to a couple of these sort of forbidden villages with a park ranger whose job it has been to evict these people, but who is now, his hands are tied, he's forbidden basically to do so. And so he sort of stood there helplessly, and he took me around to, not just to the villages, but to this area of the forest that has, plundered isn't really the word for it, it's been disappeared. It really looks like a wasteland, and Pascal has a wonderful, if unnerving, photograph, a two-page spread in the issue that shows that. But this is not just sort of, you know, a shame on an aesthetic level. It's a shame in terms of biodiversity, because these forest preserves aren't just there just because the government feels like taking land away from the people. They are so-called wildlife corridors. They are areas where, for centuries, elephants and lions and chimpanzees and other animals have mated and have moved from one area to another. And so there is a direct line that can be drawn between the inhabitation, the encroachment upon these lands, and the diminishing of those particular animal populations.
Mm.
Now, that's a shame in terms of biodiversity. It also happens to be a shame in terms of the national economy, because tourism is now
sure.
becoming one of the greatest sources of revenue in Uganda. And indeed, at Queen Elizabeth National Park, which I also visited in Uganda, the tourists primarily go there to the park to see lions. But because there are these villagers who live near the park and who were kicked out of the park, essentially, when Queen Elizabeth National Park was established in 1952, their populations are growing. Unsurprisingly, so are their animal, their livestock populations. They frequently have cattle that will graze in the park. What this means then is that lions will see these cattle out there. They'll understandably prey on the cattle. They'll kill them. The villagers get angry as a result. They poison the lions by poison in they bait the carcasses of cattle and putting poison in there. And then when I was there, a pride of lions had just been poisoned to death. Several of them had, and they were looking around for the perpetrator, and they'd arrested one guy, and I interviewed him in this village, and he was still free. They didn't really have the goods on him. But it was clear in talking to these people that there's, you know, this ongoing resentment that land has been taken away from them so that it can become a habitat for wildlife visited by rich Europeans and rich
right.
Americans, while these people are desperate for land. It's a terrible cycle, and,
right.
and of course it's easy for us, you know, to be tisking them and saying, you know, well, you guys just should have fewer babies. But there's no question that there is a population pressure rubbing up against increasingly finite resources, and that the cycle has to be broken.
Yeah. Oh, the deeper you went, the bigger the mess, huh?
Yeah. No, that's right. And it's such a shame, Kathleen, because the, you know, what's heartbreaking about it is, I think these photo spreads in National Geographic well illustrate, is that this is a gorgeous area, and
yes.
It's not, you know, when you think of a part of the world that is densely populated, you assume that it looks like Calcutta or something, and this doesn't. It's not as if every blade of grass that seven people are standing on it. It's just that every bit of land that can be made into arable land has been done so, and it's not nearly enough to support the local population. But you look at the lakes themselves, they are gorgeous. The mountains of Rwenzori and the others are incredible. And even Virunga is wiped out as it is in the eastern Congo. You still can imagine the splendor of it when it had a fully populated group of hippos and lions and the like.
Yeah. Joshua in Richland Center, hi.
Thank you for bringing this subject to the radio. I see the story that you're laying out as you speak as one that is ancient and one that is upcoming, and it has to do with me and where I locate and the rest of the people, even in North America, and that the human interaction I'm hearing with the natural environment due to the exploitation of resources, which in Southwest Wisconsin, most people would say this is God's country and it's beautiful and people are working the land. But there's ecological lessons that I'm hearing from you in your story that we could use here in North America, because we are a new country in Africa, some say, is where a human walked out of. So my question is for you is that... there's an overpopulation problem, people say, but when plants or animals or anything is stressed, they procreate, and that is just the instinct. So what can we learn as how can we interact with our natural landscape, and what lessons perhaps Africa shows us in regards to how we can interact with our landscapes so we don't end up like Africa? It may take thousands of years. But if we go on the same rate and we don't change, so I'm just wondering, and thank you very much.
Thank sure. you, Joshua.
Yeah, no, that's a good question, and I fully accept your premise that Africa is a, in a sense, a harbinger of what our continent is likely to face too, and indeed in many ways we're already facing it. You know, we suffer water shortages and there are areas where the human needs obviously run up against the imperatives of biodiversity. But I think that the lesson that was impressed upon me more than anything else during my time there was the importance of leadership that cares about its people. When you travel, as I did, across the border of the Eastern Congo and into Uganda, for all of Uganda's problems, it really is the proverbial, crossing over from the black and white version of The Wizard of Oz and into the color version. Suddenly, unpaved roads become paved. Suddenly, there are burgeoning businesses everywhere. You see, within a kilometer or two of your arrival in Uganda, elephants roaming freely about that would have been slaughtered and by poachers and put on the open market in the DRC. And so what's the reason for this? It's that Museveni and further south of Uganda and Rwanda, Paul Kagame, are leaders who, for their flaws, care about their people and have used their political capital, used their brawn, I suppose you could say, for the betterment of their society. In the Eastern Congo, you see no evidence of that at all. In fact, when I was there, I recall that I was in Goma, and the president, Kabila, was going to be coming to visit from Kinshasa, which is way to the west, and the Congo is a very big country. But he was coming all the way to the Eastern Congo because he was ultimately headed to Rwanda to visit with them, and they were frantically trying to pave the roads, or semi-pave them, throw a bunch of sand in the pox and stuff, so that Kabila, when he drove along them in his entourage, wouldn't be upset at how awful the roads are. It turns out he was upset anyway and was complaining about it, and complained to the governor about why it is that the roads aren't fixed. The governor had said, "Well, because we don't have any money," and President Kabila said, "Well, come on, you've got all these coltan and other mines, you're getting money from those, aren't you?" And ultimately, sort of in a fit of pique, the president ordered that all the mines be closed, and so it's just it's turned off the tap that much more. So this is all saddening to see, but it's a reminder to us in the U.S. It happens, by the way, that I've just completed a book on the House of Representatives, and
oh, you did?
Yes, that'll come out in May of next year. And one thing I was covering was the whole debt ceiling crisis, and what we saw that passes for political leadership in Washington is something that should give us pause before we condemn the lack of leadership elsewhere. There was a determination on the part of the leaders in Rwanda and Uganda in moments of power to help their people, and that determination to do tough things, even at the risk of angering members of, angering ethnic groups and other members of the population, that the Eastern Congo has never been willing to do. And having said that, again, as I pointed out before, and as you mentioned, Kathleen, reading that part of my story aloud, there's the president of Uganda himself basically issuing an executive order allowing, in effect, people to go in and plunder national lands. And he knows full well that that's no solution. But it's the kind of political cowardice one expects around election time.
And can you explain, from spending time there and from your studies in the area, why you would find enlightened leadership in a place like now Rwanda or Uganda and not in other places? What's the key?
Well, there's never been a tradition of it in the Congo. I think let's go back. I mean, we could go all the way back to the occupiers, the colonizers, but maybe an even better place to start is a few decades later, when Mobutu, the dictator, the military dictator who was propped up by the CIA, comes to power in 1960 or 1961. And this guy was the original, as they call it, kleptocrat. I think at one point it was discovered that Mobutu's net worth was $1 billion, and the Congo's deficit was precisely $1 billion. He had taken everything. And that part, that country has never even seen what enlightened leadership looks like. I mean, it's a fiction for them. I think, frankly, that Rwanda just got lucky with Kagame, and that's a hard thing to say, given that Kagame again has been very, very repressive, very, very backward in terms of permitting alternate points of view. But with his power, he has, I think, unquestionably used it in ways that have moved the ball forward in Rwanda, and there's never been anything like that in the country.
Mm-hmm. Bill in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi.
Can't hear you very well, Bill.
Oh, okay. Let me step outside here.
What?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay.
Hello? You hear me now?
Okay, yes.
But, yeah, a couple comments and a question and a couple comments. Bob Herbert in the New York Times had an article, well, within living memory anyway, 18 months or so ago, I think, about that the limits of growth, Ehrlich and those people that wrote about population explosion in the 60s, mid-60s, I guess the book came out, were really full of hot air, and that's never come to be a problem. And I was astounded that that was even, that wasn't just ripped out of the paper, you know, by critics, but apparently it went unchallenged. And I was wondering if the current guest had any knowledge of that or the reaction to it. Secondly,
let's take them one at a time.
Sure, yeah. Just briefly to answer that, though, I don't specifically recall that column of Bob Herbert's. So what I do know is that, you know, going back to Thomas Malthus, who had predicted a sort of population, you know, cataclysm, that had been refuted by others who insisted there would be a so-called green revolution, and that basically what Malthus had failed to recognize would be that there would be technological advancements that would allow for more efficient use of finite resources, and such that there would be a kind of exponential benefit that Malthus himself hadn't anticipated. The problem with that is that it sort of sugarcoated or painted over some intractable problems having to do with population growth, particularly in impoverished regions. And technology is an answer, but it's not the only answer, and it cannot fully address some of these shortages. So that's
okay.
And what I would like to suggest, I have great admiration for your traveling and ability to deal with so many different levels of and kinds of problems, ecological, population, political, but a couple suggestions. One is that I think some of the government ability in the colonies you've talked about can be traced back to what kind of system was left by the colonial masters years ago in British and Uganda, Rwanda, whatever, compared to the Belgian Congo, which was always, you know, Mr. The Heart of Darkness was written about the Congo for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it had civil wars that came out of that. We know about it. In terms of the Rwanda woman wanting, I think it was Rwanda women wanting to have as many children as possible, I haven't been to Rwanda, but I've studied demography, and there's only one culture in the world that has actually done that with complete they call it natural fertility, where people have not regulated childbirth, and that's the Hutterites in the United States,
mm-hmm.
about 8 children per woman. There's so many different constraints and factors that determine how many children women will have, that while it may look like they're having as many as possible, I mean, do they even have any control over their reproductive rights? I mean, there's so many issues. I would suggest that you talk to some people in the POP Council, whatever, have looked at that. I think there are other factors at work in the political structure, the cultural structure that deals with that. I mean, people in South Korea, you know, they did analyses of number of child desired and had, and there's a whole series of economic and social reasons why people have fewer, more or less children.
Mm-hmm.
And just briefly to that very latter point, I agree that there is a whole host of reasons, but it's axiomatic, and I think very hard to dispute that in these areas of grinding poverty, that we see a correlation, if not a causal relationship, between poverty, lack of education and high fertility rates. Now, as to your earlier point, I thoroughly agree, and in fact, I alluded to it before and allude to it in the story, that much of the predicate for conflict was set by the shape that some of these countries were left in by their colonizers. For one thing, there had never been any kind of racial distinction in this that we know of in this part of Central and Eastern Africa. That was a construct that was placed on that area by the colonizers themselves. They brought their own prejudices to bear in an area that had not seen those kind of prejudices before, and actually developed a sort of racial caste system that would otherwise never have occurred to them. So that's one very, very crucial problem that was or legacy of the colonies, in addition to many others. I mean, it's a lot of these colonizers, when they left these countries, left without any abiding interest in leaving behind a set governmental structure. They instead left a vacuum that was easily filled by whoever the most powerful militia happened to be, and in some cases militias that were favored for reasons of their own by Western intelligence groups such as the CIA. So you see a glaring lack of benevolence and lack of foresight on the part of the colonizers, unquestionably.
Mm-hmm. Bill, thank you very much for your really good call. We're going to welcome more in a moment. Our guest this hour is Robert Draper, contributing writer for the National Geographic magazine. He's a man of many talents. He's currently writing a book. He said we need to book him on his book on the House of Representatives. He has traveled all over the world for National Geographic. He's also the author of a book on the presidency of George W. Bush titled Dead Certain. And he's written for the New York Times Magazine, for Texas Monthly, for Rolling Stone, and other publications. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Jim in Pleasant Prairie. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning, and good to be on the air with such a thoughtful and knowledgeable guest. The issue I wanted to bring up is that of malaria, which is my understanding is usually only fatal in children and infants, and tends to be a quick, merciful death. And at the same time, the Bill Gates and his very heavily endowed foundation has decided to be the way to improve the quality of life in equatorial Africa is to eliminate malaria. And I would like to hear some comments from the guest on that subject.
I regret to say that I'm probably going to have to, better for me to pretend that I don't know, or not to pretend that I know a whole lot about this. The reason why this particular subject, a salient one to be sure in most parts of Africa, did not come up during the time that I spent in the Albertine Rift, is that the Rift is known, and indeed it has been one of its many attractions for the people who've migrated there for centuries and centuries, as a place where malaria does not occur with such frequency. And the reason for that is it's very high altitude, and so you see far fewer tsetse flies and mosquitoes that will bear malaria as you might elsewhere. And I know this because, Kathleen, you've alluded to, another story I'd done in Afghanistan. And that's, there I was, as I was when I was in Somalia, as I've been in many other countries, regularly popping anti-malaria pills that I did not have to take when I was in the Eastern Congo.
Mm. Oh, that's fascinating. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Josie in Sheboygan. Hi, Josie.
Yes, good morning. I agree with everything your guest is saying, and I really respect all the work that he's done and all that. But, he's not enough. There's not enough of them. And it seems like we have so much education, information, people writing about the problems and the reality of what's going on for years and years. And I do remember Paul Ehrlich years ago. He used to come on the Tonight Show and talk about population explosion and all that. And people laughed at him and ridiculed him. And it made me aware of it. And this was a long time ago. you know, in the early 70s. And it made me wonder, wow, you know, I was very young then, and I didn't know much about it. But it just seems that nothing gets done.
Robert.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm afraid that's true. For one thing, it's a very thorny problem. It's a lot easier to, you know, here in America, for example, to, you know, have fun arguing about whether the president actually has an American birth certificate than it is to talk about population problems in Eastern Africa. And yeah, I know what you're referring to. Ehrlich was one of the people first sounding the alarms. And it's, again, a lot easier to say, you know, look, we've got technology that can overcome this kind of stuff. But I have to say, you know, even at National Geographic, we struggle with stories like this because they're downers, frankly, and hitting readers over the head with, as we frankly have done with a series, you know, that we're very proud of on the 7 billion mark that we're about to hit. It's a challenge because we know that readers can bear only so much. And so one thing we attempted to do with the story was, for one thing, to disaggregate these problems of population and to view what's going on in this area in narrative terms, to find actual characters, so just to find like this village of Shasha, so that people can see it more in human terms than in statistical terms. The other thing is, frankly, photographically, to capture, as Joel Sartori and Pascal Maitre have in their remarkable photographs, the beauty of this area, to remind people, you know, of what the stakes are. Mm-hmm. That that this is not, you know, this heart of darkness, this wasteland. It's a gorgeous part of the world, and one of wonderful biodiversity. And we've struggled as we put this story together with how to meet the challenge of, on the one hand, addressing that, the biodiversity challenges, while not seeming so callous in the face of what are these really horrific human, you know, atrocities taking place there, and to cover both without looking sort of too academic or too detached in talking about the biodiversity piece. So it's you know, we strove in this story to find a way to invest readers in problems in a continent that that is largely viewed in the sweeping terms of misery. And there is, unfortunately, a lot of misery in Eastern and Central Africa, but it's also a remarkable place. And again, we see in Uganda important steps being taken, in Rwanda really important steps being taken, and thus are given some sense of hope where otherwise it might not be plainly visible.
Yeah, and what a task you had, because you had to look at, as a earlier caller referenced, politics and the environment and so many deep issues, and you also had to look at the history of all of this. I mean, you were taking on a lot when you did this.
I was, and you know, I don't want to come off as an expert on this stuff. I mean, the journalism is, for all of our best intentions, at times a kind of dilettantish pursuit where you immerse yourself in something for a period of time, but you do only the best you can in trying to represent centuries of history and the lives as they're led there. On top of which, it is logistically very difficult in that area, particularly in the Eastern Congo, which is a very dangerous place. It's not a place you travel around in the evening. It's not a place you travel around on foot. But at the same time, at National Geographic, we don't like traveling with a bunch of security or something, because then it's a buffer between us and the people we need to,
right,
to talk to. And
yeah.
So there's a security balance that needs to be struck for us, and it requires a lot of planning, but also a lot of willingness to deal with plans gone awry, as they routinely do.
Thanks, Josie. We have about a minute left. Jane in Ashland. Hi.
Hi. Do you have any? Ever done any articles in National Geographic about the study of the cultures of the various peoples of the world, especially on what they believe about sex? I'm saying that because I think the word is not overpopulation; it's overcopulation.
Well. The direct answer to your question is yes. We have done stories on sexual mores throughout the world. The thing that I would caution is for Westerners such as ourselves to be basically saying that sex is okay for us and not okay for them, and that no one needs to regulate our reproductive or copulating habits, but that that regulation is required elsewhere. I think that's a very slippery slope, and one I would caution people from instigating.
Robert, thank you so much for being with us. It was really a fascinating hour, and I hope you'll join. We never got to Afghanistan. We'll have to do that at some other time, but I hope that you'll join us for an hour-long conversation on your book on the House of Representatives.
Sure, I'd be delighted to.
Thank you.
So.
Thanks, Robert.
Sure thing.
Robert Draper, he is a contributing writer for the National Geographic magazine, and his piece, I've got all his pieces in front of me, so I'm trying to find the exact title. The one that we were referencing this hour appears in the current issue of National Geographic, Rift in Paradise. It's about the Albertine Rift and the ecological problems, the population problems, the tribal problems, the colonial roots history, and it's good. He's a heck of a writer and a wonderful speaker. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in Milwaukee Studios. We'll be with you tomorrow at 9.